You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Dr. Melody Fox right here on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza. Every Monday from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time, this show will bring you guests that can inspire, educate, and entertain you while bringing you answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. Answers for the Family will address issues such as locating your runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, or dealing with addictions, and so much more. With many years of experience working with families in crisis, I've been fortunate to meet and work with some talented authors and top professionals who are working to make this world a better place for all of us. And we will bring you some of these incredibly talented and caring people each week as we bring you Answers for the Family. Now, unfortunately, my delightful co-host, Dr. Melanie Fox, couldn't be here this morning, but I know that she was looking forward to this interview. In fact, she texted me stating that she thought it was a great book and that she had recommended it to quite a few parents who have questions as to what to do about their teens who seem to completely engulf themselves in their technology and their technology devices, which I thought was kind of interesting with what we're talking about, and she was texting me the information. Well, that leads us to our topic, and our topic today is the digital age. And the digital age has descended upon Americans like an avalanche. Digital tools have transformed work, school, and leisure. Do you realize that Facebook didn't exist in 2004, and now it has more than 5 million users? Now, teens with cell phones chalk up an average of 3,339 text messages per month. What does that mean? Well, we're going to ask our guest about that and much more. So with us today is Mark Bauerlein. Mark is a professor of English at Emory University in Atlanta. He has served as director of research and analyst at the National Endowment for the Arts from 2003 to 2005. His current book, The Digital Divide, provides arguments for and against Facebook, Google, texting, and the age of social networking through a collection of essays by leading voices on the meaning and impact of the digital revolution. Mark, welcome to Answers for the Family.
It's great to be here this morning, Alan. Thank you.
Well, it is good to have you. And as I started with, I just thought it was rather interesting that kind of at the last minute, Dr. Melody wasn't able to be here. And sure enough, she texted me with some information to make sure that I shared. So there is our digital, revolution at work right there.
That's right. And look, let's recognize that for all the complaints one might have about teenagers being too immersed in Facebook, the digital age is a miracle. I mean, we see wondrous things happening all the time in medicine, in logistics, in communications, in science, in everything. It has improved our lives so much. And just what you noted, Melody, texting you. I mean, you don't have to sit there at baggage claim while people wait outside wondering where you are anymore. You just send them a text or make a quick phone call, and you tell them the convenience is extraordinary, and one would never ever want to go back. The only place, I think, in which we can raise serious questions about the impact of these digital tools is in our social, leisure, personal lives. That's where we see some of the habits setting in that make us question about the impact of these tools. You mentioned some of the numbers there, 3,339 text messages per month by every teenager who has a cell phone. Now, about 85% of them have a cell phone. 50% of them get their first mobile device between ages 10 and 12. Now, what does it mean? You know, we have to imagine us digital immigrants, the old people. I'm 52 years old. We have to sort of try and figure out what would it have been like to be 12, 13, 14 years old and to walk around, for instance, with 100 pictures of yourself in your pocket at all times, to be able to write about yourself every day on your Facebook page, to send out text messages to your friends and receive text messages from your friends 24/7. What does that do to one's intellectual development during those years, one's social awareness, one's expectations about the world? And these are tough questions. They don't have easy answers. And one reason why I did this anthology after doing this earlier book, whose title gives you a sense of where I stand, The Dumbest Generation, How the Digital Age Stupefies Young Americans and Jeopardizes Our Future, mm-hmm. I wanted to get this recent collection has people arguing that Facebook, texting, that these are wonderful positives and advance in collective human intelligence, and set those arguments alongside some of the skeptics, some of the people who feel that no, these tools really only signal a remarkable rise in narcissism and self-involvement in social life at the expense of civic and intellectual awareness. So these are all open questions. But I think we do need more skeptical discussion because there's so much money being made. There is so much hype going on about the digital age, and it has. It's an avalanche. Yes, Facebook now is past 500 million users worldwide. Twitter is now, in just a couple of years, a worldwide mm-hmm. phenomenon. And Google is everywhere, and it's spreading
yep.
all the time. Well, what does all this mean?
Well, and one of my thoughts, and as I was reading part of the book and read the part that you had also, I think in about 2008, had put out the book, The Dumbest Generation. And you're right, I think that tells us a little bit about where you're coming from. Now, did the second book sort of come from people contacting you or sending you essays or something saying that they either completely agree and here's why, or they completely disagree and here's why?
Well, I certainly received a lot of emails, and a lot of them are from the young. A lot of them very angry emails, which is okay, and I respond to everyone. If you're going to lay out such censure of teenagers, and I am a teacher, a college teacher, you have to respond. You have to face the music, give people a chance to shout back. Mm-hmm. And make arguments and bring evidence. And yes, there are times in which I have had a bright 18-year-old write to me. I write back. We go back and forth. And I say, you're right. I overstated that point and made such and such seem too strong. I concede that point. And Alan, listen, this is the best response that we could have. We want the younger generation to be smarter, more knowledgeable, more civically active than we were.
Absolutely.
At that age. We want them to grow up and improve. So I want every harsh judgment that I make about the young to be proven wrong. And often, when you challenge them this way, when you provoke them to argue back, you are helping make that possible. You're forcing them to make arguments, to find evidence, to defend themselves. And in the process of defending themselves, they are disproving you, at least in that individual's case.
Right. Now, at the same time, are you having young people that are starting out with their displeasure, and then as they listen more to some of your points, are maybe shifting a little bit themselves?
I think that does happen because their first response in hearing the stern elder come through among their teachers, say, or people in public, is, I don't like this. I'm offended by this. And that is because what I see when I look around, for example, on college campuses, is there is a tremendous impulse to satisfy the customers. We want college students to be happy on campus. We don't want them to drop out, which means often we don't challenge them more hard enough. We don't force them into more mature perspectives. We don't ask that they leave their adolescence behind. One of the sad facts about college life today is outside of the classroom, it is all social for many of them. They don't go talk to their teachers outside of class. They don't pile up very many hours in the library each day. No, they go do sports with one another. They go hang out with one another. They play music with one another. It really is a heavy age-segregated world for many of them. 18-year-olds hang out with 18 and 19-year-olds. Mm-hmm. They don't engage much with 40-year-olds. And so when they hear a 40-year-old voice come along and say, you got to put that cell phone away, you got to drop that Facebook, and you need to practice a musical instrument. You need to listen to intelligent adult radio. You need to read the newspaper more often. Well, again, when they have such a heavy friend-oriented world, their first impulse when they hear that voice is, get out of here. I don't like you.
or
it is, it's unpleasant. It is an unpleasant thing to hear, but it's a voice that they have to hear. When I was 15 years old, I didn't want to listen to my parents. I didn't like them. I didn't really like my teachers very much either. I was interested in my own thing, and if I could have tuned them out by, you know, at the dinner table, tapping out a message under the table, I would have. Now, young people can.
Yep.
It is, again, Alan, they can sit in the back seat of their parents' SUV on Route 5 while going up the Grapevine and conduct a social life. They can sit in their bedrooms at midnight and conduct a social life. In fact, when Pew Research did their last study of teens and mobile phones, they were astounded. I can't remember the exact percentage, but they were astounded that the number of teenagers who sleep with a cell phone under their pillow in the on position, they want to be awakened if a text message or a call comes through at 2 in the morning. So, you know, in the old days, or, you know, your mother would say to you in 1973, go to your room, you're grounded. Well, they'd send you to your bedroom, and that meant isolation. You're going to sit there and reflect upon your bad behavior all by yourself.
Well, exactly.
Today.
And the other thing that many of the kids don't realize is that the telephone in the house had a cord, and it usually didn't reach into your room.
We didn't even think to call it the landline back then. Yeah, it was usually what? In the kitchen.
Exactly.
And the phone was, I mean, there were some kids, yeah, who would sit and talk to one person for an hour. That would certainly happen. But I didn't go home after, you know, playing basketball or hanging out with my friends in the afternoon and think to myself, oh, now I'm going to contact them and tell them what's going on at 9 o'clock at night. That just wouldn't happen. Remember, I mean, Alan, are you close to my age, 52?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Do you remember being in seventh grade, say,
mm-hmm.
and the school year would end all summer long? There were many, many people in your class with whom you would not have any contact until eighth grade began.
That's right.
The next year, I mean, if they lived a couple of miles away, you know, you didn't call them. You didn't have contact. You didn't have any Facebook page that would have 50 friends on it. You would often go months without speaking to people who might be in your class.
And that's true. And in most cases, it depended on if they were within a bicycle ride to their house.
Exactly. Exactly. And so they grow up now. Your parents really have to engage in a heroic act of imagination in order to understand the degree of contact that young people have, that 13-year-olds have with one another. And there are so many possibilities, it's hard for parents to keep that in mind. You know, there was last year a middle school principal in New Jersey sent a letter home to all the parents, 6th, 7th, and 8th graders.
Mm-hmm.
And the letter said, two things, get your kids off of Facebook, one, mm-hmm. and two, get the laptop out of the bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I am not a Luddite. This is a practical matter. My counselors at my school now devote 75% of their time to dealing with social networking issues. Pictures wow. being passed around, things being said, bullying going on. And they said that in the last 8 phone calls we've made to parents and said, please, your child is doing this on Facebook. You've got to get it off. In 5 out of those 8 phone calls, the parent said, well, my child doesn't have a Facebook page. Yes, your child does have a Facebook page. So the necessity of greater vigilance is, again, it's a much heavier burden than parents understood when they were children. And again, they've got a laptop, an iPhone or a BlackBerry. They have the TV in the room, which usually, you know, pervades teenage fare to them. And so the contacts are multiple, and they happen nonstop. And this is where, you know, people always say, well, what is the answer? And I say the answer is learning to create some balance.
Exactly.
I mean, we want kids to use these tools. I have a six-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
And if I have 1 hour of reading time with him at night, I'll read a book, mm-hmm. usually a longer book. So it's a good long narrative, not too many pictures. We're doing a lot of words, a lot of characters, a lot of action. And if I have an hour of reading time with him, the old-fashioned storytelling,
mm-hmm.
and a little talking with him as well, I don't mind if he goes down and then plays a video game. You know, I mean, within reason, certain video games, obviously, but you know, some decent learning video games, or you know, his cousin gave him an old iPhone or iPod,
mm-hmm.
and he kind of fiddles around. If he wants to fiddle around, that's fine. But we've got to keep that critical mass of reading time, book time,
mm-hmm.
or you know, it could be when he gets older. If you sit with your kids again, and you're in the car. You listen to intelligent talk radio.
Mm-hmm.
You don't. You tell the kids, no, you're not going to talk, text your friends for 20 minutes. We're going to listen to ideas put forward by adults.
Yeah.
When we're at home in the morning over breakfast, we're going to have the newspaper. You guys are going to look at the newspaper too. So you're just trying to build in, again, a critical mass of non-social stuff. And again, it could be over the TV, over the radio, or mm-hmm. over the web as well.
Exactly.
It's the content that passes through it that we need to examine.
Right. And I think it also has to just do with a balance. I mean, you know, once we can establish what a balance is, and I, you know, I'm part of that, the parent that when my kids were younger and I had the little televisions, screens in the back of the, you know, the headrest and stuff for when they were in the back. But the rule of that was that we had to be going somewhere that was at least an hour away. If it's over an hour away, we can use it. If it's not, then we will talk, we will listen to the radio, we will do something else. And again, part of that was, you know, it was for my benefit too, because when we were going out to see grandpa, that's a 5-hour drive, you probably want to have them watching something.
And again, you know, we took a drive across the country. We got a little DVD player for our little boy.
For the trip.
So that he isn't, you know, we're just on the highway. It is boring, and we can only just talk so much. So I would read to him while he's in the car. But then, you know, after a half an hour of reading, okay, you can watch a Scooby-Doo video for a half an hour. Exactly. It's the balance. And as you know, balance is something very hard for teenagers to achieve by themselves.
That's right.
And that's the thing. This is nothing new.
Mm-hmm.
When I say the dumbest generation, it sounds like I'm glorifying the baby boomers or the greatest generation. No, not at all. If we had the possibility of these tools, we would do the same thing. Because of the social element of these tools, they are an instrument now of peer pressure. All these tools could be a great big window. They are a great big window onto the universe of knowledge, history,
mm-hmm.
you know, museums, fine art, politics, current events, geography. It is all there. But that's not what these tools mean to 15-year-olds. They mean what 15-year-olds really care about, other 15-year-olds. And so peer pressure goes back, you know, 60 years. Now it just has a whole new arsenal. And I, you know, in my classes, obviously students can't use their cell phones in my classes. Well, the first thing they do when they leave class is flip it open and see what's going on, because they've been out of the network for an hour and a half. They want to know what's happening, and the stakes could be very high. for them. There could be something that says, we're all meeting at Starbucks, get here now. Well, they don't want to be left out. You know, it's a powerful draw to be with your friends. It's very comforting. Or it even could be a text message that says, I don't, you know, a loved one says, a boyfriend or girlfriend says, I don't think we should see each other anymore. Bye. This is the stake of being out of circulation. Right. And I don't know about you, but I think it'd be a horrible condition to suffer. The kind of peer pressure and peer absorption that young people have today, it just doesn't seem to stop. And you know, if I could give anything to young people today, it would be you can be alone for a while. In fact, it's mm-hmm. crucial for you to spend 2 hours in taking a walk and being alone with yourself.
And your thoughts.
You may feel lonely. It may not be pleasant, but one of the achievements of adulthood is learning how to be alone. And you've got to practice that. And you can't let these tools make it so that when you walk somewhere for 30 minutes, you've got this impulse to reach into your pocket and say, who can I call? Who can I text? No. Be by yourself. Be with your own thoughts for a while.
Right. And, you know, it's interesting because, I don't think 30 years ago you could expect that there would be a new type of industry that's growing. But I have a gentleman that I met from Germany, and he travels all over the world, and he's not the only one that does it. He travels all over the world, and he sets up quiet retreats, and you go there for a week, and you don't talk. You go there just to be quiet. Now, you can be quiet with other people, but you go there just to think and to delve into your own thoughts, and that's it. I mean, literally, it is a retreat that people pay for to go and be quiet.
You know, Alan, I think the average 18-year-old would go crazy, at least for the first couple of days, would find this deeply irritating to go without.
I think the first day, maybe the first day and a half or so, I think that they would, but I guess I'm a very optimistic person, but I think that once they get through that initial irritation and that initial shock, I think they would start to find things that would intrigue them to the point that they would listen. They listen to themselves.
I would agree. I mean, maybe they would say, hey, I can't talk to anyone. The pressure, a little bit of the pressure's off.
Yeah.
Our computer went out a couple of months ago. We got a virus, our home computer. And Alan, they were the most calm days I'd spent in a long time. Mm-hmm. Because when I pass the computer, I can always just, I'll check my email.
Yep.
I feel that urge, but when it's just taken away, suddenly life seemed to open up. There were other things I thought of doing. I actually sat and read a book without interruption for a couple of hours. It was wonderful. But again, if the computer came back on, I would return to my old habit.
Well, and I think that as you were saying that, the first thought that I had was the initial stress that I would have knowing that I wasn't checking the email, and what was I missing? Who was trying to get a hold of me that I wasn't getting back to them? You know, so I think that's the initial thing. And again, but I think that after a period of time, we would get beyond that. Some of us, it just might take a little longer than others.
The world didn't end.
Yeah, the world didn't end. And if it did, we would want to be the first to know.
That's right. Well, I think that capacity to say on your email, I'm gone for a few days, is probably a great relief to be able to say this so no one thinks that you're insulting them by not getting back. And, you know, you realize, again, the world is not going to stop if you don't check your email for 2 days. But we're so conditioned otherwise. We're so speeded up all of the time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you said to a 15-year-old, you know, on this computer, I used to have to dial a number to get in to the website. And sometimes it would take a few minutes. Now, they can't imagine. This would be perpetuity to have to wait that long. That's how much we are being conditioned to speed and access. I mean, do you remember the days when the remote control on the TV came out?
Oh, yes.
Such a big deal.
Oh, in fact, well, and I've got a story for that as well, in the sense that I conduct seminars in nonviolent crisis intervention, and I do it for my own employees as well as other businesses. And when I do this, and I've done it for so long that there's a place in that seminar to where I say, look, what you're trying to do with this person is you're trying to change their focus. Think of it as changing their channel. And I turn my hand in the motion of changing a channel. And I have, and I've had some of my young employees look at me and they go, "What are you doing?" and then I changed it. And this was quite a few years ago. Now I've since changed it to where I make the pressing motion of right. of a remote control, and now they know what I'm talking about. But I made a motion, and they're clueless. They go, "What are you doing?" So yes, yes, you're right. You know, there are times in which, in fact, not only do I remember turning the handle to change it, but I remember when it broke. I mean, after I had moved out from the family home and had my first television, and it broke, and so I put vice grips on it, and we turned the vice grips to change the channel.
Well, yeah, if you want to really, you got to just mention the word rabbit ears.
Oh yes, you know? Oh yes.
This just shows how quickly now we become acclimated to new technologies. You know, one thing I noted in the book was something like YouTube. Now, YouTube is an amazing creation, but when people look at YouTube now, it's so familiar that they don't even notice how remarkable it is to get all these movies. They're so taken up on the content passing through it that the tool itself. It's just like water to them. This is just the normal habitat. And people forget things like a world where there was no social networking. And this was only a few years ago. Facebook, you know, just came out six years ago. Twitter came out, what, 3 or 4 years ago? No one even knew about Twitter until about 2 years ago, I guess. And yet we assimilate these tools so quickly now. I mean, the telephone was invented. It took about 30 or 40 years for the telephone to become a common property in homes. Well, now, you know, something comes out, you know, a tablet, the new tablet technology, and boom, everyone's got one, and they just, again, absorb it as a normal feature. Of the landscape within a matter of months.
Well, and I think and with the telephone, you bring up a great point, because now many people now are getting away from the home phone. So the concept of having a landline now is becoming foreign to some. I have people who I call, and you know, it's okay. You know, we've got a bad connection. Can I call you on your landline? And they go, "We don't have one.
We don't
have one anymore. Why bother to have one when each person in the house has one attached, you know, to their belt?"
Exactly. Exactly. The landline just looks, you know, fatally inconvenient at this point. And with all of the tools, one of the issues is that the manufacturers, the inventors of tools, they are in a race to outdo one another. They want to come up with the next big thing, the next commodity, and get it out on the market quickly and capitalize on it, which means that the rest of us consumers are constantly faced with the next version, the new rollout. You know, Facebook just a few weeks ago introduced all these new apps, and you know, it feels like we're constantly scrambling to stay on the cutting edge. Of things, and you can't read a newspaper, you can't watch TV now without encountering the new technological advance.
Right.
And, you know, one wonders how long can this go before we just start feeling saturated and overwhelmed?
Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, and then the other part is that now in regards to watching television is that it's become interactive, so that at the same time in which you're watching something, there's a ticker going along at the bottom saying, if you want to comment on this, whatever it is that's on, go to www.fill-in-the-blank, and you can comment while the show's going on. So I think now with this form of interaction, we have people watching things and feeling that they now have the right to have an opinion, to have a vote, to have something tied directly to whatever it is they're watching at that moment, rather than passively just sitting back and enjoying it or just taking it in and analyzing it. You're now involved in it. And I think that is not only where we're at now, but where we're going to go in probably a much bigger way.
Right. And a lot of the contributors to this volume talk about this technology as Web 2.0. where the web certainly evolved in the late 90s and early aughts into, again, a participatory medium. Amazon started allowing customer comments. And this was very unusual, because a lot of retailers said, wait a minute, you're allowing people to comment on the things that you're selling, and a lot of those comments are going to be negative. Do you really want people to be trashing the things that you have sold to them? And one of the insights of Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon, was, no, this is going to bring people to the site, is going to get them more involved, and they will buy more books because of this. Mm-hmm. And he turned out to be correct.
Yep.
The New York Times, on the editorial page or the blog page, various blog pages, you'll rack up 800 or so comments. I mean, I mentioned in the introduction of this book this infamous excerpt from the Tiger Mother book. Mm-hmm. It came out about 8 or 9 months ago, where an Asian American mother who was a Yale law professor wrote a book saying that Asian forms of parenting, focus on grades, academic achievement, discipline, no parties, no games, not too much TV, no video games, no sleepovers, you get A's, you do your homework, that this is so far superior to the American or Western mothers, as she put it, which highlight too much self-esteem and social activity and fun.
Right.
And this excerpt came out, and within hours, this was floating around the web. This excerpt, everyone was starting to comment on it, and on the Wall Street Journal page, where you have to sign in under your own name, they don't allow any pseudonyms there, you had 5,000 comments racked up. So people talked back. Now, Alan, I pose the question, when you've got 4,331 comments, why are you bothering to make the 4,332nd comment? I mean, do you believe that this makes a difference? Is this just about you feeling good to be able to say what you think? Now, some people think that this is a wonderful expression of democracy. People, you have more voices, more opinion. You can make your opinion heard. Some others of us wonder if this is just, again, a form of futile expression. And ultimately, it's narcissism. Just seeing your own words on the Wall Street Journal page and wonder, what is the impact of this?
Well, and I think it's not really any different. I think it goes along the lines, seeing it on the page or hearing your own voice. I've had complaints being in large committees and having somebody make a point and then having 10 other people that have to make the same point, and they start it with, I agree, and here's why. And I agree, and here's why. And it's like, you know what? We get it. And at this point in time, can we call for a vote? You know,
Alan, I'm in academia, so that's my world.
That's your world.
meetings that go for 119 minutes should have lasted 19 minutes.
Yes.
But yeah, this idea of every voice has to be heard, and now the web is cultivating that expectation among youths. You know, through those teenage years, the expectation that it's up to you to state what you feel, say what you think, give your opinion about things, and one wonders if that is really a realistic expectation for young people to grow up with. I mean, I've had people say, rise in the audience when I give lectures, and I state the tough thesis, and they will say, well, I have to say that I am very offended by this statement. Even your title is offensive. And I wait to hear more. And I've started to say, that's all? You're just expressing that you're offended? Don't you want to say more?
Yeah. What's your reason?
Why do you think that your feeling of offense in itself is something that should be put on the table that the rest of us have to register? I mean, give me evidence, give me arguments, show me that I'm wrong, and let's get the discussion going. Your statement is a conversation ender. there's nothing. All I can say is, oh, okay, you're offended. Well, what's the next thing? Next question.
Right. Well, we've talked quite a bit in regards to Facebook. Facebook has come up quite a bit, and we got some questions that were sent in by our listeners, and one of which was very simple, and it was from a mom that says, at what age, it says, I have multiple children just starting to break into their teens. At what age do you feel it is good for them to have their own Facebook account, and why?
That's a judgment call, I think. You have to look at the child's whole life, whole situation. One can see that there are areas on Facebook and social networking in general that can really benefit young people. I mean, they always bring up, you know, the oddball in school, the kid who feels, you know, left out, who feels ridiculed, for the kid seems different in some way. Well, online, sometimes that youngster can find a more sympathetic community. And within limits, you know, as long as it doesn't become all-absorbing, that can be a good thing. There are other cases, obviously. The danger is that, you know, kids are bullying each other, they're gossiping, they're doing what kids have always done. And now they do it over Facebook, which gives them a lot of power. Instead of just, you know, passing a note around in class, a piece of gossip, they can post it and hit 400 people with that piece of gossip right then and there.
Yep.
So that's just a heavier weapon. But what I would say to that mother is that you make the judgment call on the broader social situation of your child, because I tend to think that Facebook will just amplify what is already happening in that teenager's life. And so you monitor when you can, but also you sustain, again, a critical mass of non-social engagement with your teenager. Make sure that your teenager spends a critical amount of time away from the other teenagers. And that could be, again, just some reading time. How much does your child read books? How much does your teenager pay attention to, get involved in a political campaign? You know, the presidential campaign is coming up. Do you want your child to get involved with supporting Obama or something, some kind of commitment that is, again, not founded upon their friends. Just another thing going on in your child's life. I would say that fostering that just gives your children somewhere else to go. Might give them a reprieve mm-hmm. from that social world, which can often be a horrible gauntlet of judgments that they have to suffer. If they don't feel they have anywhere else to go, that is crushing for them. And remember, a lot of them experience high school with dread every day.
Well, I not only agree with what it is that you're saying, but I would add one more thing, and that would be that whatever age in which you feel that your child is mature enough to have one, add one condition to it. They friend you. Okay.
There you go.
Okay. They need to know that you have access to it. And so that when they're putting things on there or their friends are putting things on there, they need to know that you're there, you're seeing it, just as if you were having these same friends invited over to your home. If you invited them over to your home, and if you have a 15-year-old boy and he invites a 15-year-old girl over that you know that he likes, you're probably not going to want them in the bedroom with the door closed. Okay, you're going to want them to know that if they say they're studying, that the door is open, or that they're in the kitchen, or that they're somewhere. So I think you can take it to the things that we understand, as parents, or what we learned or were taught when we were younger. I think you can transfer that also over to the same thing.
Alan, after a lecture I gave, a man came up. He worked in human resources for a large firm, and he said, it's interesting what you said about Facebook and privacy, because we're at the point now where we do a lot of hiring. We get a lot of applications. We throw out 30% of the applications in 10 seconds. He said, we simply Google the person's name, and we get Facebook. We get any pictures that come up, and too many of these people have pictures that show them with a beer, guzzling a beer at a party or something. And we all did these silly things when we were young, but they just think, why this person is applying for a job and having these pictures out there, we can just move on to the next person. We need to narrow down the applicant pool, so this is a good way to do it. So I would say, let your teenagers know that all the material that goes out there is potentially accessible to teachers, to employers, to recruiters of various mm-hmm. kinds, and to the parents of your boyfriend or girlfriend. and so just say, I'm not going to put anything out there that I would not someone I respect want to see.
And I think, and it is a great point, and add to the fact of the economy that we're in right now, where I've talked to many young people that say that they're going in, they're applying for a particular job, and there's 500 other people applying for that job. So, I agree completely. Take all of the advantages that you can have to your, use them to your benefit, and don't put things out there that, as you're saying, is going to get you immediately taken out of the pool. So that's a great point. Let me go to another question. I want to get these in, and I can't believe the time has gone by so quickly. So we have another.
I'll shorten my responses.
Oh, no. Believe me, this has been great. But it says you would think that with the explosive access to anything and everything on the web and TV, that our teens and 20-somethings would be more knowledgeable on the world and current events. Unfortunately, my kids are blank slates on anything but the names of their favorite musicians, entertainment celebrities, and fashion labels. I try to engage and involve them constantly, but with little success. Can you give us some advice on the growing problem that parents and teachers alike are facing?
Here is the thing to remember about knowledge issues, knowledge of history, of current events, politics, and so on. If young people don't feel any personal commitment, if they don't feel any personal meaning to these materials, they won't remember them. They might study them for a test. they might feel they have to know about them for some reason about college or about some upcoming event. But when it's over, they forget about it because, again, they don't feel any personal commitment to it. And so this is a place where parents and teachers have to step in and let students know, listen, I'm going to tell you some stories, for instance, about my past. I'm going to tell you about, or a grandparent would say, let me tell you what I did during the civil rights movement. Let me tell you about a grandparent or a great-grandparent who served in World War II or a grandparent in Vietnam. In other words, you have to pass along some deeper value, some human import to a lot of these materials. And that's where it goes beyond a test. Mm-hmm. It goes beyond just being mercenary about something. Well, I got to learn this for my college application. Where, you know, a good teacher says, all right, let's look at Macbeth, the Shakespeare play Macbeth. All right, look what happens. Lady Macbeth says, Macbeth, do it. Do the killings. Go after these people. Do it. Do it. And then when Macbeth does it, what does Lady Macbeth do? She falls apart. She goes a little crazy. Have you guys ever been in a situation where someone is urging you to do something and do something, and then when you need that friend to come through and support you, and that friend collapses, all the strength is gone, and you're on your own? I mean, I don't want to push too much the relevance issue, because these materials have to be studied in and of themselves, but you need a hook. You need to make these materials come alive for young people so that they do take them in and hold on to them as, again, part of the formation of their character, part of the things that are going to make them reflect upon the kind of person they want to be and what the world is really like and what it has been like. You tell them what it was like to listen to Martin Luther King speak, how inspiring those speeches were, and then what happened in the wake of those speeches. This is I think the best I can offer, making young people realize that what might have happened 40 years ago, you know, on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, or 48 years ago in 1963 in the summer, this is really important.
Mm-hmm.
So this is my suggestion.
Well, and I love your point about, you know, tell them a story, but then tie it to something that is relevant in their life now. And I think that is a huge difference in many times what other kids are hearing. In other words, if they hear something, I think after a while, I mean, and you know, be it coming from a parent or a teacher or whatever, you know, if we're just talking at them and saying, you need to know this. That's one thing, but I love the fact that you're saying, you know, this is something that you can benefit from and take it and tie it into your life today. How did that affect you today? Or how does this level of communication deal? How do you use that same type of communication with your friends? So I love the fact that you're doing that, and I think we got just a little bit of time. I'm gonna throw one more quick question, and I think it says Jay Leno had a wonderful segment where they hit the streets during the show and asked people simple questions. I have to say that all ages, not just young people, came back with the most ridiculous and uneducated answers. What is your opinion about this issue being very multi-generational?
I have to agree. I'll go along with that. And I'll also say, yeah, older people always gripe about younger generations. Yeah, it's been happening forever. Mm-hmm. And I would say when people respond to that, well, this is our job. This is how we help adolescents grow up. We give them, again, the stern rebuke for being self-involved and for thinking what goes on in high school is of earth-shattering significance. Yes, And it's also good for younger people to resent that, to say, you're just picking on my generation, and you're getting a little narrow-minded, and there are things going on in the world that you don't really know about yet, and we are more tapped into it.
Great.
It's a good thing. Good thing.
Great.
We need a little good productive tension between the generations.
All right. Well, Mark, thank you. One last thing, and it's just, you know, so for those interested in your books, and again, the books are The Digital Divide and or The Dumbest Generation. And for more information on this subject or to get those books, where can the listeners go to find them?
Oh, we've got the website. It's dumbestgeneration.com.
Okay, and that's got to be easy to remember. And again, if you didn't get a chance, if you're driving, you couldn't write that down. If you go to our website, it is answers4thefamilyblog.com. And if you shoot us over that question, we will direct you to, again, www.dumbestgeneration.com. Mark, thank you so much for being with us, and I look forward to talking with you again.
Thank you, Alan, for the time.
All right, take care.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio.